All right. So today, the title of this talk, as when it's posted to the website as audio and video, you'll have to come up with a title because I don't know what it's about yet. Because we're going to do more of the spontaneous answers to collected Dharma questions. So I've collected these questions from people live in Dirt, Sendo, and Cloud, and some of these are ones that have been submitted to me via the website. There's a little, you know, submit a Dharma question to Domeo button. So yes, volunteer to draw things out of the envelope and just keep the envelope. Just, and there's all different sizes and shapes of questions in there. So kind of.
Okay.
And yeah, it's here. And I'll read it.
Oh, okay.
All right. In regard to Soto Zen's characterization of just sitting, does Brightway Zen or Soto Zen in general have a different perspective to other sects when it comes to Nirvana? Well, I think, so I was reading the question, I was thinking, talking about how our view of just sitting might differ from other Soto Zen or other kinds of Zen sects. I see the question as Nirvana as being, I'd be curious to talk to the person who submitted this question as to how they are connected. But I guess they're probably connected in the sense that in original Buddhism, if you will, not that there's really such a thing, but from what we can tell from the extant scriptures about what the Buddha taught, he talked about practices that we do in order to, one way to phrase it was achieve Nirvana. So that is a big topic in and of itself. What exactly is that? And that was definitely, you know, sometimes the Buddha would go into that. What is that? It wasn't a straightforward thing like, oh, everybody understands that. It's a kind of elusive idea. But the put it in a nutshell, like Nirvana was a state, is a state of peace, freedom, liberation, freedom from fear, freedom from harmful desire, freedom from, you know, greed, hate, and ignorance. So at the Buddha's time, 2,500 years ago, he was part of a spiritual, wider spiritual development in India. There were a lot of alternative religions arising in addition to the Vedic traditions, which was more of like the main cultural traditions, which were tied to the caste system and to priests and to rituals and a certain view of the universe. And alternative sects were arising, which were essentially saying, how can we free ourselves from karma? So karma is like behavioral cause and effect. So karma is what leads us to suffer in some senses. Karma is what leads us to be who we are. Why do I have this personality, this body, these life circumstances, and you have a different one? Why am I fortunate in this lifetime, and why are you unfortunate? People were contemplating these questions, and the, all the Indians of the time subscribed to the idea of rebirth, so that the idea of when you died, you, some part of your essence was released from your body, and then it tended to be reborn in another form. perhaps in an animal or another person. So it was viewed that there were many different circumstances you could be reborn into, and you wanted to be reborn in a good circumstance. So then they came up, well, here's practices you can do, ways you can live, things you can do in order to affect that future. Be reborn in fortunate circumstances, or even more radically, and this was the Buddha's point of view and the point of view of some other traditions of the time, including Jainism, where the idea wasn't just to be reborn in fortunate circumstances. The idea was to be released from the whole cycle. Now, this is a kind of at odds with our modern way of looking at things, where I think most people I know would just be like, I'm going to be reborn. That's cool. I mean, I'm glad it's not the end. I mean, we don't think of being born again as being a terrible situation. But the way they viewed it was like, when you're reborn, it's like you forget everything that came before, and you go through the struggles, and you go through the heartbreak, and you go through the love, and you go through the loss, and you go through all of it, kind of all of that turmoil again, life after life after life after life, and you don't really kind of get anywhere or necessarily learn anything. So the view of nirvana was you reach a state, a place where you're not going to be reborn. You're not going to be sucked back into this cycle of desire and fear and longing and all these things that keep us. They say when you're floating around after death, you get sucked back into rebirth because of some kind of, you know, something unresolved, some kind of desire, some kind of fear draws you back into being reborn. Now, all of that is a kind of a big digression, because that whole teaching is not really central to Zen, which is probably what this question is getting at, right? So what is our goal? So, and I'll just a little sidetrack there. So then nirvana, there's two different kinds of nirvana. Actually, this ties to the commemoration of the Buddha's death on February 11th. There's the nirvana you might attain in this lifetime, a state of freedom and calm and spiritual liberation. But then there's parinirvana, which is happens when you die, and then you are not reborn, right? So that's like the complete release. So, you know, Buddhism, the beautiful thing about it is that it has continued to evolve, and it continues to evolve, and hopefully it will continue to do so that the Buddhism 500 years from now doesn't even look like this. Who knows? It's probably going to have to incorporate like alien life and who knows what else, right? So, you know, Buddhism went from India to, you know, Tibet, it went to China, it went to Southeast Asia. Our lineage went through China and then to Japan and then to the West. So the whole goal kind of shifted. I think it probably started in China, where the Chinese were much more grounded, life affirming, you know. We're moving into a culture that had Confucianism and Taoism. There's some argument that kind of Zen and, you know, Buddhism meets Taoism is kind of what results in Zen. So this kind of life force, this kind of affirming life force. So the idea of just this kind of, we're just trying to get free of all this terrible place, it starts to morph. And you might say that we started to see nirvana in more metaphorical terms, instead of being it a literal thing that like this person might attain and that person might not attain, and it has to do with what's going to happen after you die. It being You know, what would be a state of nirvana this moment? Maybe not a permanent place we attain, but a moment of peace and liberation. So we say essentially, you don't have to, because the idea originally was like, you're going to have to work a lot in order to attain nirvana. You're going to have to leave behind your family and job. You're going to have to meditate all the time. You're going to have to, like, the way, you know, hardcore self-discipline. And you're probably going to have to do that for multiple lifetimes before you attain this rarefied state. Instead, we're saying, as we sit, we can taste that peace right here. And part of the teaching is that we attain nirvana by releasing our desire for things to be other than how they are. This is all part of the original Buddhist teaching. We release our resistance to how things are. So that's what we're just trying to do in our zazen. Every moment of our life, we're making this a moment by moment practice of release. So we don't really focus on, like, some final state. I mean, I don't know, people might talk about enlightened people or something like that. I am extremely skeptical of that, and I don't think it's actually even helpful, unless that really inspires you, I guess. But there are definitely more enlightened people and less enlightened people, right? We can all experience moving closer to being able to access that kind of peace and perspective. We can make it more a part of our lives. It can be closer. It can be easier to access at any given moment. And we never look at it as like, well, I've attained that. Last October, I reached a state and I've been perfect ever since. I mean, that's not what this is about. This is about living this moment. So I don't know if that approached it, but it's a good shot. That's why this is fun, because it's like, that's just kind of spontaneous. Additional, like, kind of follow-up questions or comments about that whole deal. I don't know if anybody's been confused about that before. Like, you go back to older Buddhist teachings and they're talking about nirvana, and like, why don't we ever hear about Zen people talking about nirvana? Jessica. You're still muted.
Thank you. For me, what comes to mind is the pitfall that you talked about in a previous talk about wanting to cling to those moments of peace that I experience and wanting them to come again. And I find that's a challenge sometimes. And so you're just reminding me that it's about right in this moment, and don't cling to that, let go. So I don't know, I'm not very good at that. But
yeah, and I don't know, it's like I feel like Zen kind of approaches all of this from like this meta place, meta, like a bigger over, because just as we say like nirvana could be this moment, we say nirvana and samsara are one. So samsara is the world of suffering. It's that world of being sucked back in to our conditioning, to our karma, to our fears, to our desires. That world of samsara, or the world that we're reborn into. But then Zen saying they are one. It's the same place. Like, even in the midst of all of this change, there is peace can be found if we don't resist even that, you know, like that moment of peace is gonna go. We will get caught up again, And from a Zen point of view, it's like, as long as we feel tortured about that, we're still just caught in self-centeredness. We're still just, you know, fixated on what this self is going to experience and what this self has achieved, as opposed to, like, you know, we're just riding this karmic wave. We're just trying to, like, surf. We're trying to just learn how to just, you know, go with the flow and be in this strange existence we found ourselves in. Stuart.
Okay, got it. Apropos of nirvana and rebirth, I'm just curious whether it's very rarely mentioned in Zen environments that I've been in, Zen venues, but it seems to be to have a much bigger place in other versions of Buddhism. And I was wondering, is that the nature of Zen practice, or is it the fact that it's been westernized to be more accommodating to Western sentiments?
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, I don't really know from personal experience, right? I haven't studied in China or Japan, but I do think it is a characteristic of Zen, but it's not... I don't think any... in the past or the present, any Chan or Zen, you know, teacher is going to, well, they might, they're not going to stand up and say, there is no rebirth, there is no nirvana, right? We're not in conflict with the teachings that came before. It's an evolution and a shift in emphasis. So we're not, you know, we're not setting ourselves up to be contrary to that. We're just saying, you know, I don't know that that's the most important thing to focus on. To some extent, we even say, like, and to some extent, we look back at the Buddha's own teachings to justify this position. Because he gave teachings that said, know for yourself. Base your practice on what you can know for yourself. And I have not verified the reality of rebirth for myself. And I don't know how to go about doing that. There are other Buddhists in the world, particularly Tibetan Buddhists, who do. Like, they believe in rebirth and they feel like they have verified it for themselves. And so I remain, like, agnostic about that, right? But it also doesn't bother me. I mean, maybe there is to some extent, right? It doesn't, my practice is not dependent on that being true or that not being true. So that's how I would say. There are definitely forms of Buddhism where it is very central and very, very important. But Zen just, I don't know. Just focused on something else. Denny.
What you just said about nirvana being the same as samsara, you can't have one without the other. And we need to be comfortable with both of them. Is that in some sense, an explanation of equanimity, being able to hold both of those at the same time?
Yeah, I think that word could be used. And that sense of equanimity being bigger, being able to hold it all. A good way to put it. All right, should we move on to another?
think it might be too. I'll let you
start. I stapled two together because they're kind of related. So let's see. Would you say a word about spiritual bypassing in Zen, such as saying it's all empty to someone who's upset? And why the Bodhisattva doesn't minimize the distress of others, but really listens when we can as aspiring Bodhisattvas? And then this other question, which I thought was related, is how is the teaching of no self related to compassion? So, one of the central teachings in Mahayana Buddhism, so this goes beyond just Zen, this is a whole branch of Buddhism, is the ideal of the Bodhisattva, who works essentially, to use the terminology that we were just using, like could disappear into nirvana, but chooses, so instead of, like, they don't have to be reborn. They've liberated themselves from the fear and the desire and whatever, so they don't have to be reborn. But they choose to be reborn to benefit living beings. So other beings are still stuck in samsara, so the Bodhisattva chooses to be reborn. This is the mythology about which we can remain agnostic or believe it or not have it featured largely in our practice. But the model is that the Bodhisattva comes back to free beings and makes a vow, which those of us who have formally become Buddhists also take the four Bodhisattva vows, one of which is beings are numberless, infinite, I vow to free them, and that means all of them. And there's descriptions in detail of what this Bodhisattva vow means, like not just people, but everything that is born, whether it's born of an egg, or if it's born of a cell, or if it's born of like all the different ways that they imagined living things arose, free all of them, and even beings who you can't even conceive of being beings. And like, I mean, it's just, the list goes on. It's like all forms of life, you are going to free from suffering, which of course is impossible. And if we really thought like, I am going to do that, like it's very arrogant. And also just would be very exhausting. But nonetheless, we make that impossible vow. And what that means is there's never a point in which we're like, good enough. The rest can drown. You know, like we never stop. It's just, it's an unceasing intention to help all beings, including ourselves. But part of the process of reaching that state of liberation, of generosity, of selflessness, of equanimity, is awakening to various truths. The truth of emptiness, the truth of no self. I've been really saying that what this is about is awakening to reality with a capital R. It's one reality, and there's many different ways to describe it. It has many different aspects. It has one aspect that we say, you know, how it's a not self aspect. Nothing is my self nature. I can't grasp not my self nature. There's nothing fixed. Everything is impermanent. And thus we say everything is empty of inherent self nature. Myself, you, everything, the chair, the Zen center, everything is, but there is nothing There's no graspable essence. There's no autonomous essence living inside of each of us that is navigating our life and is the protagonist of this life. We think there is. We evolved to think there is. It's actually an adaptation. Like it's, we think of ourselves and we can kind of like, we have a narrative of our life. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this this afternoon. And then I'm going to talk to you. And like, we create a narrative of our life and it's functional. But it's not, there's no graspable inherent reality behind that. And just that, really awakening to that does liberate us from suffering, because we're not worried about the well-being of this little self. So on the one hand, like the Bodhisattva might, you know, meet a suffering being and say, you know, just realize there's no one there. Or even to backtrack a little bit, to say, you know, the Buddha's original teachings about us, our desire for things to be other than how they are, through practice, we experience the letting go, the relief of dukkha when we let go. You know, and it happens over and over. We might be in a situation where we're like, oh, this is, I don't like this. I don't want this to be this way. And then we take a deep breath and we just, this is how things are unfolding. And we just let go of that resistance and feel that freedom from suffering. So we might have the spiritual insight to look at somebody, and probably no matter where you think you are in practice, you've probably had this experience of having somebody talk to you, friend, family member, child, and they're miserable, right? They're just, oh, this is so terrible. I'm so sad. I'm so miserable. I don't know what's going, you know. And then from your perspective, you can see. You can see maybe it's not as big a deal as they think, or that, you know, things are going to get better. Or maybe you see how they're kind of creating their own suffering, and maybe they can kind of let go or forgive or whatever, right? You can see it. And you want to be able to like, come on, just get over it. Just let go. Just forgive. But it's not, that doesn't mean the person can do it, right? Just because you have that perspective, somebody else may have that perspective on your issues, right? You have that perspective. It is not necessarily helpful for you to just tell it like you see it. You have to be, that's what we call skillfulness. We have to, and compassion. So I might think of it like this. If a little child comes to you and their favorite crayon has broken, and they're distraught, they're crying, they're, oh my God. I mean, you are not upset, right? You know, there's a lot of crayons in the world, and that, you know, 10 minutes from now, the child will be thinking of something else. But you feel compassion for their suffering anyway. You don't, hopefully, if you're compassionate, you don't belittle them for their suffering, right? You don't say, crayons are stupid. Like what? You feel compassion. They are actually suffering. So you feel, you may have perspective, but that is what allows you to be supportive of them. So the Bodhisattva does this as well, and doesn't do this kind of, you know, I'm going to give you the medicine of emptiness and no self, no matter what problem you bring to me. Like, there's no real you here that's suffering. Like, it's not compassionate, and it's not helpful. So we really listen be out of that compassion. But then at another level, like what this question is getting at, when one of the main Mahayana descriptions of the Bodhisattva, right? So it describes how the Bodhisattva is going to save every last being They work tirelessly and selflessly. I mean, the Bodhisattva, I mean, an absolute minimum of self-care, right? It's like just the Bodhisattva. But it says the Bodhisattva does all of this without the thought arising that there are beings to save or that I am saving beings. So in a sense, like, so sometimes like the Bodhisattva sees it all as if it's a dream. So they know there is no inherent essence in this person. They know that suffering can be released just like this. So where does the compassion come from? We think of compassion as being like something that I feel. I look at you and you're suffering and then I feel sad for it and I want to do something for you. And that's true. I mean, that's a kind of compassion. But they say, ultimately, compassion and this sense of emptiness, compassion is like the hand reaching behind you in the pillow for a pillow in the night. There is discomfort. The hand reaches for the pillow. We're not even, we don't think like, oh, you know what wonderful thing I'm going to do. And we don't do it because we're like, I'm going to do something really nice for my head. Like, when we realize that there is no boundary to self and all beings, all things are self, all beings are part of us, then it is simply a natural response. If you are suffering, it's natural, just an automatic natural response. It's not a self-conscious thing that I'm trying to do to be a good person. There's a place and a time for that too, right? It's just a response. So it's not that the Bodhisattva is doing all these great things for all these suffering beings. It is the natural flow of compassion that we are, that is just coming through us. So I don't know. See, though, this is why I like the spontaneous response thing, because, you know, I would take this and just, you know, I'd spend 3 hours writing an elaborate linear talk about it. But now I just have to kind of go, how about this? So any more ideas or comments or related questions? Passion. Emptiness. I guess I could say something about the spiritual bypassing part of this question. So this question touched on a lot of things. I guess just like we were talking about, the Bodhisattva does not necessarily just prescribe, you know, emptiness or no self or whatever as the teachings to help another being. When we are practicing with our own suffering, we have to be careful about what Dharma medicine we apply. So spiritual bypassing is not, it's a term that was created, it's not, it doesn't apply just to Zen, any spiritual practice. Any spiritual practice that you do, which can, you know, relieve your suffering, give you some perspective, give you some equanimity, etc. And so in a sense, the practice is good, but you can use some practices to skip over what we call in our lineage is karma work. It can skip over issues. So for instance, maybe you have, you know, a really dysfunctional relationship you're in. So, you know, you just go and you meditate and you're, you know, you have a nice quiet room. You go meditate in and it makes you feel good again. And then, you know, you kind of use the way that spirituality can give you some solace and some peace as a way to not deal with things. And that we there's no shortcut around those things. I think we all can acknowledge that we can ignore things or deny things or paste over things. But the only way to really resolve these things is to go through them, is to really see them clearly. And sometimes that means we need to feel things, we need to deal with things, we need to have hard conversations, we might need to make changes in our life, we might need to, you know, work on difficult habits, etc. So anyway, any additional thoughts? Coral.
This is just a comment, actually. I've been working on the spiritual bypassing thing for a while because it's like one of my big pitfalls. And we talked about this in the beginner's mind, and actually she talks about it again in that illumination book as like, you're basically in charge of your own suffering. Like, what I mean, like, in a very purist sense, like the self and all this stuff, like that's, it's kind of like your deal. You choose what to suffer about a lot of the time, right? And when I first learned that, I was like, wow, I'm so empowered. I get to choose, you know, and I can kind of let these things go. And I kind of was chewing on that for a while. And then I would get in fights with my husband and I'd be like, you're in charge of your own suffering. So that's like, I'm not doing this to you. This is your problem. Mm-hmm. And that's where the compassion part comes in. And I have to like, all right, I believe this. And I think this is true, whether or not it is, I don't know. But it's definitely a path of mine right now.
Yeah. Well, and you remind me that there's another way to look at the teachings. You can kind of put them into two pots, if you will. And one are our relative teachings, or the dependent dimension teachings. And one are absolute teachings, or the independent dimension teachings, the kind of emptiness and, you know, that kind of thing. And reality is both of these things. So in the relative, we have precept work. We try to practice right speech. We try to, you know, even if we don't naturally feel compassionate, we try to be compassionate and generous. We do our karma work, we try to work on our habits and pay attention to the effects of our behavior on other people. And, you know, so we're working on suffering in that realm. And we're also working on suffering in this independent dimension realm and recognizing how, like, yeah, in a way, this suffering is just, this is something that I'm making up. Like, I can just release this instantly, and so can you. And there's not really anybody here. Like, and like, you know, those deeper truths, which can be very, they can give us perspective and solace, but reality is both of these things. And so a miss of application of the teachings is often when, you know, we're dealing with a relative situation, and then we try to apply an absolute medicine. Or maybe we're in retreat or something, and we're trying to awaken to the absolute aspect of reality, but then the relative keeps on coming in and like, but what about this? But what about this? And we need to try to attain this and do that. And it's like, that doesn't belong here. So anyway, that's another way to look at it. Are we, and you'll see, there's a kind of a formal question and answer ceremony that we will do sometimes, called Mondo, or when a teacher does it, it's Shosan. And people ask questions, and the speaker is, you know, speaking from their direct experience, and they're trying to meet the person's question, like we said, like two arrows meeting in midair. So somebody who has a really deep and comfortable sense of the Dharma will be able to, like, if you come up and ask me a relative question about, like, you know, how do I sit with less pain? You know, and be like, pain is an illusion. Like, you know, that's an you asked a relative question. I gave you an absolute answer, right? But when you come and you know, you ask me a question like, you know, why are we here? I'm going to be like, because we're listening to a Dharma talk. Like that, you ask me a deeper question, an existential kind of question, which wants a different kind of answer. So, did you still need that? Mark?
So I have in the past struggled a lot with the Bodhisattva ideal. And I'm not now. And so I thought maybe I would trot that out and let you respond to where I'm at. Might be interesting. Ideals are really dangerous, right? You can get very neurotic about, am I living up to this ideal or not? And so for the longest time, the Bodhisattva ideal made me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And the idea of a Bodhisattva's compassion being some ideal I had to live up to made me really uncomfortable. And where I'm at now is Bodhisattvas, they're named for what they do in the old texts, right? Like never disparaging Bodhisattva. And there's this way in which they have these really human characteristics, mm-hmm. right? They have the characteristics of an ordinary being. And it transforms this Bodhisattva's compassion from this ideal into the life of a human being who's been freed to lean all the way into the things that their life has taught them. Mm-hmm. And that bottomless energy goes from being this exhausting thing you have to live up to just living an honest life. Now, am I making excuses for myself or have I hit on it? I wonder. Still that little hint of neurotic fear lurking around the corners.
I mean, we can elude ourselves with any of the teachings, right? And I usually find that once I hit on something and I'm like, I don't know, 6 months later, I kind of lost it, right? I like, what was that again? And then, you know, it's like the mind, it just gets its little fingers into everything and ruins it. But that's why we just keep on moving, you know. But I think that's a beautiful way to put it. I mean, yeah, I similarly, like, ideals can be really I think I have so much of a problem with ideals because I love them so much. Because I look at the ideals and I'm like, oh, if only, mm-hmm. if only it could be like that, if only I could be like that. Oh, and I love them so much. And then like, but life, there's nothing like that, right? I mean, my ideal of like, I'm going to become active against climate change, and then imagine all those ways that it can be, and then, you know, and I go do it, and it's like, it's people, and it's like organizations, and it's slow, and it's not very rewarding, and you get burned out, and like, like life. But then where else is this Bodhisattva thing going to unfold? And I really like that idea of kind of leaning into, I mean, who are we? I shared before one of our scriptures, the Avatamsaka Sutra, ends with a chapter with like 54 different Bodhisattvas, the spiritual seekers going around and visiting each Bodhisattva. And, you know, it's like, please tell me how to be a Bodhisattva. And then the Bodhisattva explains, well, I do this. Like I have, you know, I give people whatever they want. They like show up at my door and they want this, they want shoes, they want food, they want whatever. So I give them all this stuff. And that's what I do. But I don't, like, I can't really tell you how to be a Bodhisattva, but you should go visit that person. And then it goes on to the next person. Then the next person is like, I don't know. It's very varied. It's like, I don't know. I can't remember the details. I have some podcast episodes on it, but like, you know, somebody who's just, you know, give spiritual teachings, or I think there's one guy who's just really gruff and like scares people straight. But I just think, you know, so part of this is like this deep self-acceptance of who we are exactly, you know, in this imperfect manifestation. You know, I don't know. I would be Bodhisattva who explains clearly. Like, you know, I don't really do anything else. I'm not going to give you a lot of stuff. You know, I don't have a lot of patience. I'm not going to be, you know, there's going to be the Bodhisattva who just listens really, really well. I always wanted to be that, right? I picture a Bodhisattva being that. I'm never just going to walk by you because I have something to do. I'm going to stop and I'm going to listen. I'm going to listen to how, you know, and like, I don't have time for that. I got a lot of stuff I'm doing and I'm just like, it's hard for me to slow down and listen. So it's like, as long as I hold that ideal, that's not the Bodhisattva. I mean, that's not to say that I shouldn't try to listen to people, right? That's not really the Bodhisattva I'm meant to be. I think that's a beautiful vision.
Thank you.
I just think, yeah, I'm watching Ted Lasso, and you just, for some reason, you made me think of like, what is it, Roy? You only know if you've been watching it, but he's a really, really, really like gruff guy. And he's just like, ah. So he ends up going on like to be a sports commentator. And like, he just is who he is. And like, people just love it. They're just like, look, he said, Roy, what do you think? Because the other commentators are like, well, I noticed they really, they moved this player over here and they did that. And Roy's just like, they play for shit. Like, and people are like, oh, this is just so refreshing. Don't know what we have to give. So we just have a few minutes left, so just like, let's just kind of let things arise rather than take another question. Bodhisattva activity, ideals. Your name again?
John,
come up so you can be seen and heard.
Ooh. So much of this resonates with me. Idealism, sometimes falling in love with the idea, but not the practice. That's something I've definitely struggled with because I'm a very much in my head sort of person by my nature. But regarding all of this, one phrase that came to mind throughout the conversation was meeting people where they're at.
Mm.
And I really like that phrase, because for me it helps encompass that idea, especially if you're speaking relative problems, not answering them in some kind of the absolute.
Mm-hmm.
And also built into it is an idea of compassion, right? How do I, in order to really meet people where they're at, you have to take perspective. You have to, in my view anyways, you have to get outside yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I also think that it applies turned inward, meeting yourself where you're at, right? So understanding that you're not at a place where you can be this ideal of a Bodhisattva, that you have a particular nature, and that is part of the whole conundrum. That's part of the whole process. And simultaneously accepting it and working with what you have. All easier said than done. But another follow-on idea quickly, and unfortunately I usually have like a flight of ideas associated with all of what people are saying, which is why it's so thrilling and interesting for me. Contemporary cognitive science has a picture of different kinds of knowing that I think is relevant to what we're discussing. And there's propositional knowing, which is like saying, I know that you know, a bike weighs this much, and I know that when riding a bike one must do this, that, and the other thing. But then there is procedural knowing, knowing how, not knowing that, but knowing how.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally uses different parts of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And when we confuse one for the other, can cause problems. And there's yet more perspectival knowing, which is mm-hmm. taking the perspective of another, and then some argue that there's participatory knowing, mm-hmm. which is more of a social, relational sort of knowing. But I find those at least easy, good categories to help understand some of these challenges. Good tools, cognitive tools.
Yeah, and I don't know if this, the way that I'm going to describe it fits with these definitions, but what springs to mind is, like, to some extent the teachings are telling you what's possible. They're telling you that you can release your suffering. They're telling you that you don't have an inherent self nature, right? They're telling you, and frankly, if I hadn't been exposed to the teachings, that probably never even would have occurred to me. I remember when I first encountered the teachings and they suggested I pay attention, even like to mundane things. I'm like, why would you do that? Why would I pay attention while driving the car, washing the dishes? Those are just things to get out of the way while I'm going to do the things I want to do. I mean, it was like, really? So it's telling you that, you know, you could learn something. You might be, might be happier if you did this. But then our practice is really, okay, I've been told that, I've learned that, I hope that, I have faith in that, but how do I do that? And that is really like, how do we let go of our suffering? And that's something that will arise over and over, right? Will we sit there going like, okay, I've been practicing for a while now. I know I should be able to let this go. I know that in theory, I should be able to let this go. But it's, and I feel like, I mean, it's an exploration of our experience. And for me, it's almost like I've described this before, like you just keep on messing around in there until you just find this little switch. And you go like this, like, I can let go of this anger. Look, and I mean, you don't even, can't even explain like why that is, or, you know, what this switch is connected to, but you found it. You found how to do it, but you had to live it. Nobody can tell you how to do that in your own body mind. So thank you. That's a nice thought. Nice provision. All right. Let's call it a day. This time I'm not calling a day early. abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha. Thank you all for being here.
Bye. Bye-bye.